And we have with us live in the studios, once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Starting our day with local news, not a lot this week, but Mike McGinn coming out with some policy statements here this week.
Yeah, the local news has been really thin this week. I think it's because we only have one newspaper in this town anymore. And
they're very selective about what they choose to cover and not cover.
Yeah, they cover mostly spot news like car accidents and bank robberies, that sort of thing.
Just like the TV stations.
Exactly like the TV stations.
Or that new mall in Bellevue I saw them cover 4 days in a row.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Funny thing about that, and you know what? They advertise with the Times. It's a remarkable coincidence, but what I'm sure that
Amazing.
Didn't impact their news judgment at all.
Oh, no, I'm sure it didn't. And then the other thing they do for local news is the Times tends to manufacture these little controversies around progressives and progressive candidates and try to pass that off as news. This week they...
Darcy Burner.
Yeah, this week they reported that Mike McGinn wants to extend light rail to the west side of Seattle. And from, you know, Ballard all the way down.
I'm shocked.
To
I'm
West
shocked.
Seattle,
it's a horrible controversy. Yep.
And, you know, I looked far and wide for a policy paper on it, and I didn't find much information. What I had to assume then was that he had made some offhand comment that this might be a way to deal with taking down the viaduct and not replacing it with a tunnel by expanding transit, and that could include something like this. Of course, as if he becomes mayor of Seattle, he won't be able to make the decision on that. That would be a Sound Transit would be in charge of extending the light rail lines, and it would be a tri-county.
Yeah, unless he got the state legislature to change the rules regarding what the city could tax itself for.
Yeah,
and that's not
setting up
setting
up a local transportation district and all that kind of stuff. He probably wouldn't be able to do that all on his own. What I found interesting is that McGinn has issued some real policy papers this week that the Times didn't cover. For example, the one I found of interest was, I think he, a policy paper I think he issued early this week on ways to save money in the city of Seattle, something that, of course, Mayor Nichols hasn't been doing at all. And McGinn's policy paper had some very interesting items on it, including consolidating departments, especially the managerial staff of city departments. He made the point that managerial staff and advisors to the mayor have expanded in number quite a bit during the Nichols administration, and that would be one of the first things he would do is go in and trim all that and consolidate some of that. I also thought it was interesting when he has proposed consolidating City Light and the Department of Utilities in order to save money too. I think these are the sort of things that the Seattle Times should be reporting on, and they're not, and I just find their local reporting to be execrable.
Yeah, what execrable. One of the things that had really stand out with the Times since the PI went away is that the firewall between editorial and their news coverage has really gone away. And where this turns up here is that they don't cover things like, for instance, the healthcare rally that happened a couple of weeks ago, where several thousand people showed up at Westlake, and there was no mention of it whatsoever in the Times. Here you have the Seattle Times, which has reflexively been hostile to light rail, not covering a mayoral candidate, and remember that they endorsed Malahan and did not endorse McGinn in the primary. They gave a dual endorsement to Nichols and Malahan, and they're not covering the substantive proposals from McGinn. And remember that McGinn has really had the rap of being a single issue candidate, that he got a lot of his votes in the primary because of his opposition to the tunnel, and that people didn't feel like he was giving concrete proposals to other issues. Well, like them or not, these are concrete proposals and they need to be publicized and debated. But instead what they're doing is essentially making a story out of a response to an interview question in which McGinn threw out something that you know, Sound Transit has studied these routes in the past, mm-hmm. so it's not as though it's an original idea with McGinn that they be pursued, but, you know, the fact that he said it is bad in the eyes of the Seattle Times because they're so hostile to light rail, so it's their attempt to make a controversy about McGinn, thinking that, well, other people will think the way that we do and that light rail is a horrible thing. The problem with that, of course, is that a lot of people actually support light rail. They think it's a good idea. There's just no accounting for taste among the rabble out there.
Especially in the city of Seattle, where light rail is extremely popular.
Yeah, also, and passed with a lot of the vote in the measure last year.
Yeah, also, it's the Seattle Times continuing to classify McGinn as a one-issue candidate. He's only about the tunnel. He's only about transit issues. And that should stop, really. But, of course, it's not going to.
All right,
and once again, we learned that the Seattle Times is really poisoning their political news coverage with their own opinions.
Yep.
Moving on, Greg Nichols, mayor of Seattle, still a couple months left, trying to do something, proposing something about guns.
Yeah, once again, remember last year he tried to ban guns in city parks and city property, and that proposal got slapped down by Attorney General Rob McKenna, who's a Republican and a guns rights advocate. But it also is consistent with both state and federal law that doesn't allow cities to do that kind of thing. Nichols has come back again this time with a less ambitious proposal. This time he wants to ban guns in city parks, quote, frequented by children, which I don't know exactly how legally you define that.
Aren't all parks frequented by children?
Well, you know, there's some parks, like the park across from KEXP, that are mostly frequented by drug dealers and homeless people, but in theory, yes, they are all frequented by children.
Some of those homeless people are children.
That's true also. But I don't know how on earth you would get a legal definition of which parks are frequented by children and which parks are not. But in any event, this proposal is really no different in its substance from the proposal that was slapped down by the Attorney General last year as being illegal. This would be illegal on the same ground, so it really seems more like a publicity stunt than anything else. And you know, you'd almost think that Nichols was still running for office. But you know, the real key takeaway from this is that you. And this is, you know, despite the fact that I think this is true for both Maria and I, that we are supportive of, you know, controls on the rights of people to own and carry guns. There's places where guns are simply
certain types of guns.
Yeah, they're simply inappropriate. But you know, you can't do things that are illegal in terms of trying to set up regulations that the courts have already found won't pass muster. You're just setting the city up for costly and time-consuming and expensive lawsuits. So this is what has happened. But the real takeaway from this is that you just need to go running, not walk, but go running. Anytime you hear a politician say something is for the children, or we're doing this for the kids, it's generally a real good marker that something doesn't hold water, but you want to feel all warm and fuzzy about it inside, so you won't think about it very carefully.
All right. Moving on to national and continued instances with the healthcare debate coming up.
Okay. Yeah. The Congress had left healthcare reform before their recess was a bill had been passed in three House committees and in one Senate committee, and the Senate Finance Committee had still been left to act on a bill to pass. They were looking at a way to pay for healthcare reform. They had to draft and pass their own bill before it could go to the Senate floor, and then the House and Senate could vote on their different versions and then try to reconcile the two versions of the bills. Well, this week the Senate Finance Committee, headed by Senator Max Baucus, proposed a healthcare reform bill that is, to put it mildly, a giveaway to insurance companies. It's the
Health Insurance Company Enrichment Act of 2009.
Yeah, it is literally the Republican bill, I would say. Baucus is a Democratic senator, but this is a Republican bill. I mean, there's no question about it. It contains no public option at all. All the other versions of the bill that passed the House committees and the other Senate committee, the Senate Health Care Committee, all contained a public option. This one does not. It would set up co-ops, not one co-op, but co-ops in various states, I'm guessing,
yes.
that that would provide options to people for health insurance coverage. It would require people to have health insurance coverage, but not require their employers to provide it. And it would increase the burden on workers to pay, workers and the unemployed to pay for their own health care. Without providing any limits on what insurance companies can charge.
Yeah, it is a mandate that requires that individuals, and that includes every person listening to this radio show in the United States, requires that people purchase the insurance coverage, but there's very little in the way of subsidies to make that affordable to people. There's no limits on what insurance companies can charge, and there's very few limits on ways that insurance companies can then turn around and deny coverage to people who actually get sick. So really, it's forced business for the very companies that have contributed so much to cause this problem in the first place. It is a really, really dreadful bill, both from a policy standpoint and from a political standpoint, because, you know, guess what? When word gets out about what this bill actually contains, a lot of people are going to be very, very angry about it.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the thing is, you know, a lot of times conservative Democrats like Baucus, who's from Montana, which is nominally considered a red state, although it's been trending more blue recently. Normally, the rationale for this is some kind of a conservative fiscal rationale where it costs less. But this bill actually does not cost less than a public option costs. It costs quite a bit more because of the subsidies to the insurance companies and the lack of savings that would result because, you know, prices are not going to go down. There's nothing in this that would actually control prices. The only rationale that can be provided for this particular bill is that it enriches the insurance companies and therefore protects the jobs of people who work in the insurance industry. It is a absolute corporate giveaway, and the reason it's getting so much attention is because this is seen as the most conservative of the bills that are now on the floor, and this is seen as the one that is most likely to be an acceptable compromise to enough Republicans that it can actually get passed with 60 votes in the Senate that would beat a filibuster. Whether that's actually what happens or whether the Democrats are going to go to a budget reconciliation process next month that would require only 50 votes to pass, but would also require that the bill be budget neutral, that is to say that it wouldn't actually cost anything. Why you can spend billions of dollars on wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but you can't have a health care bill that actually costs anything is a bizarre product of our political process. But,
yeah,
you know, let's not go there for the time being. But this is seen as the bill that has the best chance of reaching consensus in Washington, D.C., and it is worse than doing nothing. It is an abomination.
Right. And what was interesting about this, as Jav said, it's a Republican version of the bill proposed under the excuse that, well, we have to find some kind of a plan that we can pay for. In other words, the fiscal reasons. What was interesting to me is that the plan to pay for this bill in the bill would levy an excise tax of 35% on what are called Cadillac insurance plans that charge premiums of more than $8,000 for individuals and more than $21,000 for families. But
these are the plans that cover what used to be covered by all insurance coverage.
Right, and what's interesting to me about that is that that only raises about half as much revenue as the House proposal. The House proposal would levy an income tax surcharge on wealthy taxpayers that would raise about $544 billion over 10 years, whereas the Senate Finance Committee bill would only raise about $215 billion in the same time period. So it doesn't pay for itself, and it actually will raise less money than the House version that contains the public option. So what I also want to talk about, too, is this week the Kaiser Family Foundation released a survey about health insurance premiums. I thought, okay, look, these so-called Cadillac plans are you know, $8,000 for individuals and $21,000 for families. How much, on average, are people actually paying for health insurance premiums? Well, the Kaiser Family Foundation issued that report this week, and it said that the average premium for U.S. families is now above $13,375 per year, And for individuals, it's about $4,824. That's average. In the state of Washington, I think it trends higher. I know at my workplace, we pay more than that. The increase in premiums this year was 5% in 2009, but there have been double-digit increases each year for much of this past decade. And over the course of the last decade, health insurance premiums have risen by 131% since 1999. That's an amazing increase.
Yeah, I pay close to that now for an individual policy that doesn't cover very much.
Right, right. And what's interesting too is that the Kaiser Foundation survey found some other very interesting things too, that deductibles are up. 22% of workers pay more than $1,000 in deductibles, which is up from 10% of workers who paid about that amount in 2006, just 2 years ago. And it also found that 60% of employers offer insurance coverage, which is down from 66% 10 years ago, that 8% of employers were considering dropping coverage altogether, which would bring that total down to 52% of employers in the United States offering health insurance coverage to their employees, a bare majority, and that 21% of employers reduced benefits or made their employees pay more costs on their insurance plans in the past year, and that an additional 15% raised workers' premiums, but that also more than 40% want to make employees pay more of their premiums in the future. So that's a continuing trend, that in order to avoid double-digit increases in insurance premiums paid out of the company's pockets, employers are doing one of two things, or a combination of these two things. They are either raising the deductibles on their plan, sometimes as high as $5,000 to $10,000, making those plans literally unusable, making the insurance literally unusable for their employees, except in the case of a catastrophic illness, or they're forcing their employees to pay more of the premiums or the costs of the plan. That's the current trend. And what's very interesting is that people are resistant to healthcare reform, but at the same time, this is the very reason for healthcare reform. Every year, we are paying more for our healthcare, and we're getting less at the same time.
And this really underscores the fallacy of something that Obama has been saying continuously, that there is no logical connection between what you do for a living in your terms of your job and your need to get health care coverage. But the reason Obama has rejected single payer out of hand is that, well, you know, traditionally we have an employer-based system in this country and we have to go with what we have traditionally. Well, what we have traditionally is falling apart without his help. We're getting fewer and fewer people that actually have that linkage between their workplace and their health insurance coverage, and there's going to be less so as time goes on. Why are we insisting on keeping that linkage? It hurts especially small businesses, but all businesses that have to bear some of that cost, and it hurts workers who lose their ability to be mobile in jobs and lose their ability to
we need a single payer plan to actually have
coverage.
Yeah, we need a single payer plan.
All right. Moving on, this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week, U.S. District Judge Jed Rakoff threw out the SEC settlement deal with Bank of America over the Merrill Lynch bonuses that were paid directly after the merger. The SEC had proposed a $33 million fine plus no admission of guilt on the part of Bank of America. But the judge turned around after about a month ago saying, look, I'm not going to approve this settlement out of hand until you give me some more information on how you negotiated the settlement. The judge turned around this week and said, okay, this settlement does not comport with the most elementary notions of justice and morality, because it would require the shareholders, who were really the victims here, who were lied to by Merrill Lynch and Bank of America, they are the ones who would have to pay the fine. And the judge thought that, look, you cannot let the Bank of America upper management get off with forcing the shareholders to pay the fine, and
which
then
is almost always what happens.
And then take no admission of guilt, because clearly somebody was at fault here. In other words, the judge was saying the SEC cannot accept this settlement. They have to take the upper management of Bank of America to court and prosecute them. So that means CEO Kenneth Lewis is probably looking at a trial here. And I would just want to point out, this is unprecedented. Generally, yeah, with these high-profile settlements, the judge just kind of waves it on through and says, okay, fine by me. This is unprecedented. This judge literally threw it back at him and said, look, SEC, you have to do your job. Go after these guys.
And it's a level of accountability for the corporate executives who commit malfeasance in cases like this and usually are not held accountable for it. And the judge in this case is
said enough.
Shock of shocks, yeah, actually insisting that they be held accountable.
Yeah, he said enough.
All right, and it was an anniversary this week for Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, a lot of the news this week was talking about a year ago when the collapse of Lehman Brothers Bank set off a panic on Wall Street that was sort of the beginnings of the financial meltdown. A lot of it was folks in the business press talking about how, oh, the Bush administration should have bailed out Lehman Brothers. That would have avoided the whole financial downturn. It would have avoided the loss of confidence in banks, et cetera, et cetera. But that's really ignoring the fact that Lehman Brothers Bank deserved to fail. They really were in terrible physical shape. They couldn't meet their debts. There really was no one who would purchase them at the time that they failed, even though the CEO had 6 months to sell the company, and he had two or three really good offers from bigger banks to buy the company. He decided not to do that, and he literally let Lehman Brothers get into worse and worse and worse financial shape. And let's also not forget that the Bush administration had an ideological bent of government should never interfere with the markets, whether that be regulating the activity of banks or stepping in to bail them out. And Lehman Brothers Bank had to fail in order to prove the error of that ideological bent. So that's just something I wanted to point out when we're hearing all this talk about how, oh, you know, the government should have bailed out Lehman Brothers, etc.
All right. Mm-hmm. And finally, the Patriot Act. Anybody want to cover that?
No, I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, well, I'll talk about it. Well, this week the Obama administration, Barack Obama, said that he supports extending three key provisions of the Patriot Act that are going to expire at the end of the year. Of those three key provisions, one of them is the government's authority to access business records, which is the provision under which the government can look at your library, everything from your library records to your online credit card orders. It's kind of shocking to me that the Obama administration would say, look, you know, during his campaign, I think the government is overreached, you know, but then after he's elected, he doesn't want to give up any of those powers, and so he wants to extend them even further, even though the three provisions include one that supposedly has never been used. It's called the lone wolf provision, which allows the government to conduct surveillance on suspects with no known link to foreign governments or terrorist groups. In other words, literally anyone they want to conduct surveillance on, they can. And the government says, well, we've never used that, which I would think would be a good reason to, let it expire.
But, yeah, I think the chances that they've never used that are slim and none.
Yeah, I think that's proof that they've used it. They just don't want to tell us.
Yeah, and it really does underscore, as Maria says, how you know, Democrats criticized these provisions when they were Republican provisions, but now that they're in power, they're just fine with having all of these unprecedented powers that are really clear violations of the intent of the Constitution and privacy. And it's really very interesting how the prairie provinces in Canada are now under something of an economic boomlet, and the reason is that all sorts of companies are setting up shop there that have because they have privacy privacy restrictions that don't exist in the United States, so that they're out of reach of some of the ability of the government to pry that the United States has. This is actually hurting the United States economically, but none of that seems to matter when it comes to government expanding its own power, regardless of which party is in control of the levers.
All right. That leaves us only a couple minutes for a couple international, starting with Afghanistan.
I'll go ahead.
Oh, okay. This week, it was just wanted to mention that the Electoral Commission under Hamid Karzai's government has declared him the winner of the Afghan election poll with 54% of the vote. However, the UN Oversight Committee that's been monitoring the election said, no, not so fast. We want to recount about 10% of those polling places in Afghanistan, particularly the ones that have reported major fraud. And if they take into account 10% of the vote, that means that could swing Karzai's majority under 50% and force a runoff election with Abdullah, the leading opposition candidate. Abdullah has again continued, even under extreme pressure from the Bush administration, to resist calls to form a coalition government with Karzai. And why would he want to? Karzai's government is a corrupt narco state. So it looks like there may be a push for a runoff election. That's going to be a tricky thing to pull off in a country where winter is coming on, which would make polling sites inaccessible to much of the population. And the first round of voting didn't go so well, as we see with these charges of fraud, massive fraud. Will the runoff vote be any better?
Yeah, and you know, funny how conservatives seem to be were all up in arms when Iran had its charges of fraud a few months ago, but it's very quiet now for Afghanistan.
Yeah.
All right, and a missile shield that doesn't appear to be moving forward?
Yeah, the Obama administration reversed the Bush policy this week about setting up missile shield, essentially Star Wars, in the Czech Republic and Poland. This was something that was strongly opposed by Russia. And the same day that announcement came out, reports came out of Russia that Russia was considering doing a 180 and supporting U.S.-led efforts in the United Nations for further sanctions against Iran. Those are sanctions, of course, that'll be discussed next week when the UN General Assembly meets. Is there any linkage between the two? Well, everybody seems to think so, even though Russia denies it.
All right. And any events for this week?
Yeah, a couple of them. Today, Mobilization for Climate Justice will be held at the Cascade People Center with panels, workshops, and strategy sessions. That's at from 3 to 7 p.m. at 309 Pontius Avenue North in what used to be called the Cascadia neighborhood before the creeping cancer known as South Lake Union took it over. And then Thursday, September 24th at 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall, Max Blumenthal, the investigative journalist, will be in town flogging his new book, Crises Among the Radical Right. So go and check that out, too.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library Center, blowing around in the wind down a deserted street. You can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, any of that kind of good stuff, or you want to volunteer, because we always need volunteers, drop us an email at info@eatthestate.org.